Hello, and welcome to a special edition of The Stooshy, the weekly politics podcast by DC Thompson Media. As you may have noted already, my name is not David Clegg, it's Callum Ross, and I'm the investigations editor at The Press and Journal. I'm going to be sitting in Mr. Clegg's Stooshy hot seat for 1 week only, because today we'll be discussing Generation Next. Now, if you don't know what Generation Next is, then I might ask, where exactly have you been? Because for this special project, we put the focus on 35 young and ambitious budding politicians, all age 35 or under and from north of the Central Belt. In doing so, Generation Next tried to capture a glimpse of what our political future might look like and has been described by Kezia Dugdale as a real tonic for the times we live in. All 35 in-depth interviews went live on the P&J and Courier websites almost 3 weeks ago and can still be found there now. So I would urge you all to go and check them out if you haven't had the chance to do that already. Now today I'm delighted to say that we are joined by five of the rising stars who are featured in the series. From the SNP, we have Caelan McMahon, who's a Glasgow University student and national convener of Young Scots for Independence, which is the SNP's youth wing. For the Conservatives, we have Braden Davey, who's a councillor in Angus and who famously, perhaps infamously, depending on your view, defected from the Labour to the Tories a few years ago. Sticking with Labour is Dina Tezera, a PhD student and former student leader in Aberdeen. And for the Lib Dems, we have Orcadian Jack Norcoy, an Aberdeen University student who was described by his local MP, Alistair Carmichael, as one of the brightest political talents I've ever come across. So no pressure there, Jack. And last but not least, we have Max Hall, who is based in Dunfermline and works for the Scottish Greens at Holyrood. Now, I haven't spoken to most of these guys since our profiles of them all were published, so hopefully they are all still speaking to us. But we were keen to bring them all together five of the 35 together to explore some of the themes which emerge from the series and other issues faced by younger people getting involved in politics today. Caelan, I wonder if I could come to you first. There seemed to be a lot of positivity in terms of the response to the interviews, but also the engagement between the people who participated. You're obviously still heavily involved in youth politics at the moment as a leader at YSI. Do you detect any kind of generational shift in the way younger people in politics are dealing with each other these days, or is that just wishful thinking and will it all go out the window as soon as an election comes around?
Hi, thanks so much for having me on today. I really, really enjoyed being a part of the project, and as you say, like the interaction between the participants in it on, particularly on Twitter, it was really interesting, especially for me as someone, as you said again, is still involved in youth politics, to kind of see who has similar roles to me in different parties' youth wings. And in terms of, are we all going to play nice when an election comes around? I definitely think so. I think given that we've all grown up around social media and using social media, we're aware of the negative impacts that can have. And I know that I definitely try my best and I pride myself in making sure that whenever I engage with anyone on social media, that it's constructive. And I hope that, you know, that would be the same for everyone else that's on today.
Jack, I wonder if I can bring you in now. You've also been a member of the Scottish Youth Parliament in recent years, haven't you? And what kind of characteristics have you noticed in the generation coming through? I mean, do you kind of concur with what Caelan's saying there?
Thank you also for having me on. I will echo a lot of what Caelan has just said. You know, I know amongst my peers that's interested in politics, there's a degree of civility and a kind of general consensus that we're in the business of being amongst current affairs and in politics for positive reasons. Of course, we all have a different angle at how we want to take that, but I think young people on the whole do demonstrate a very high quality of debate. You know, you just need to see that if it's a television program, on the radio, interviews, young people are engaged and often have, you know, very constructive angles to take at some of the big questions of today. And I know amongst in my peer group that I have friends across the political spectrum, and I think that's a really healthy thing to try and maintain.
Mags, you also work closely with kind of professional politicians, if you will, at Holyrood. I mean, do you think some of these established MSPs, maybe not the ones you work with, but some of them and MPs could learn a thing or two from the way the younger generation engage with each other now?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's, you know, as we've heard already, it's been really interesting to see the response to this project and kind of the welcome that's come from people across different ranges of the political spectrum to this. I think it's interesting to see a generation of digital natives come through now into politics, people who've grown up around social media and have been using the likes of Twitter and Instagram and TikTok for quite a long time now and are managing to apply it to politics. It's quite funny watching some perhaps older politicians get their heads around this and having to explain to them, sometimes we don't even get so far as to talking about tone and debate. Sometimes it's literally like, this is how you log in. This is what an Instagram is. So yeah, I think we're starting to see a shift in generation and hopefully people working with people who have grown up around social media and have seen both the positives and the negatives will result in a much more welcoming and opening use of social media rather than what we've perhaps seen in recent years.
Braden, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. I mean, you're the only member of the panel that's an elected politician. You're a councillor for Forfarin District, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would be your thoughts on what's been saying there? Does that kind of change in attitude, does that ring true to you, or do you think it goes out the window when the more kind of cutthroat politics comes around at election time or once you're actually doing it professionally?
I think overall, generally, young people are much better on online and much better at, you know, as was mentioned, digital natives. But I think, you know, it is a bit wishful to see that when young people do get elected, there is, you know, that level of torrent of abuse that's directed at them. And it's quite often directed at from an older generation towards young people and who often should know better. I know in Angus, one of my colleagues, he was in the project as well, Ben Lurie, the Lib Dem, he was forced to take down his social media just due to the level of abuse. But I think young people to other young people, I think, understand, especially young people involved in politics, because we're all in the same boat, just coming at it from different angles. And it seems to be the there is a huge amount of abuse directed towards young people. But I think overall, young people are quite nice to other young people online, because we're all in the same boat.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to come to that. I mean, I hadn't heard that example you'd just raised, and that's quite worrying. But I mean, we were aware that actually one or two others of the participants in the series, we had to take down their articles from social media because of abuse and one because of concerns about abuse. And obviously it's just terrible to think these young people are being targeted in such a way. And it's a story we've heard many times before in relation to social media. Braden, I mean, I think you've spoken in the past yourself about being on the receiving end in terms of around the time of the independence referendum and perhaps even around the Brexit vote too. I mean, how big a problem do you think it is, and what could and should be done to stamp it out?
I think it's a huge problem. I think anyone looking at, you know, politics and thinking, do I want to get involved in that, and seeing, you know, some of the abuse that's directed, can you blame people for looking at that and thinking, why do I want that level of grief? I don't think that's for me.
Yeah.
What you do about it, I think one of my personal views is that I think part of the issue is the anonymity online. You know, people can just sit behind the computer, not be accountable for the words that they use. And so I think that perhaps should be looked at, whether people can maintain that sort of anonymous account, which tends to be more aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if people were linked back to the words that they're using online, perhaps people would think more carefully about what they're saying.
Dina, I wonder if I could come to you now. I mean, I think Kezia Dugdale and others have recently made the point that it's often the case that it's women who are subjected to this abuse, although obviously it happens to men as well. But it has been raised as a potential factor in putting women off politics, getting involved in politics. Do you think that's the case?
First of all, thank you very much for having me on this segment. Yes, so in terms of online abuse, and especially in the political field, women tend to get more abuse. And when you even go into intersectionality about it, there is a women of color, women younger age, they tend to get a lot more abuse than men per se. Me myself, I've had my fair share of online abuse as well. As you know, previously discussed here, the anonymity of it can create a kind of like a safe net for these online abusers, so that they cannot be exposed. And you know, there's this kind of like they can hide behind their keyboard and be keyboard warriors. In my case, what I have tend to do is there's a beautiful button called block. So you just go and block them. And, you know, in many cases, there are times that I was able to educate, people online, obviously the ones who are not anonymous. But in the case that has failed, you know, I've been able to expose them. And, you know, I'm being able to take action against them. So I think the best way to tackle this is actually taking action. And I think the more women come into politics, and the more women of color and more women of younger age come into politics, it's going to be a normality. And we need to create more, you know, opportunity for women to come forward. And, you know, be able to bring more policies and strategies to sort of like tackle online abuse as well.
Kaylin, I wonder what you made of that, and if you had any thoughts on what we need to do to encourage more women to get into parliamentary politics.
Well, in terms of social media in particular, what I always try and say, especially to the young women who are involved in the YSI, is as much as there's not much we can really do about what people do or say to us online, it's about fostering your own healthy relationship with social media. I personally don't have any notifications on my phone. I don't get notifications of any replies or messages on Twitter. And I just make sure that I have this relationship with social media, that I can step away from it and actually detach myself from the kinds of things that people will say, especially when it does come from anonymous accounts, because 9 out of 10 times you're never going to persuade someone on social media. You're never going to change anyone's mind. So it is best to just step away from it. But at the same time, I think it's really, really important that, as Dina had said, that more women get involved in politics, and more the women who are involved stay involved, as hard as that can be in the face of these kinds of things. Because the more women that do it today mean that hopefully the next generations that come after us won't face the same kind of abuse and the same kind of pressures from social media. So I think it's definitely something to keep fostering healthy relationships online and between women, not only within parties, but across parties as well, because online abuse, and particularly online misogyny, is a cross-party issue that we all really, really need to work on tackling.
Mags, we've obviously just heard from Kaylin there. I mean, you yourself, you're actually going to be a candidate next year in the Holyrood election. I mean, was that a difficult decision to make because of some of the points that have been made, or were you just determined to do it? And what kind of thoughts would you have on the whole issue of encouraging more women into frontline politics?
Yeah, so I think it's important that we address online abuse that women face, but we really should remember that this is just one of a whole host of barriers that women face in coming into politics. And actually, it's something that comes on much later in their journey. So women tend to experience it once they've come forward, once they've stood for election, once they've confirmed their candidacy. The Scottish Greens did our selections for Holyrood last year. And as part of the women's network, I was involved in a team really encouraging more women to put themselves forward and to try and ensure that we had at least 50% women candidates on our lists. And actually, it was really eye-opening for me as a woman who, you know, work in politics already. I don't have a family at the moment. You know, I'm quite already engaged, speaking to women from different backgrounds and in different circumstances. It's a huge challenge to even start considering yourself coming forward for politics. The two biggest things that people spoke to me around was firstly, the incompatibility with politics and having caring responsibilities. Mm-hmm. So difficulties around childcare, around the hours that the MSPs in particular are expected to work, around travel, you know, remote participation, that kind of thing. And then the other second thing that came up again and again is the incredible rates of imposter syndrome that women have. The number of women I spoke to who were really qualified professionally in their fields, had loads of community backgrounds, you know, experience in local grassroots politics, but didn't think they were good enough to stand as politicians. Mm-hmm. It was really eye-opening. And I think the best, you know, for that particular issue, the best thing you can do is get women in a room with some of our sitting politicians, our MSPs and councillors, and show them, you know, what the current standard of elected representative is at. And I think that begins to start to break down barriers and women can see themselves in those positions.
And Dina, I mean, as well as the need to have more women in politics, you discussed in your interview with myself about the lack of diversity in Scottish politics and how you kind of felt a personal responsibility to try and do your bit to achieve greater equality. I mean, that's a massive issue as well. And how do you think we break down those barriers? And I suppose, what are those barriers?
Okay. So for me, when I was, you know, initially starting off with student politics and going forward with the Labour Party, I didn't see a political role model where I could see myself through. So that was a problem there. And I'd like to thank you guys so much for recognizing me and making me a part of this segment, because a lot of people, a lot of females from diverse background has reached out to me saying that they are inspired to get into politics because they've seen a colored female featured in a segment like this. So thank you very much for that. So giving opportunity for women like myself, who are, you know, it's just not only just identity politics. I don't want to completely put that on identity politics itself, but women who are capable of doing the job and women who are, you know, who are willing to and go forward and actually take the job and do it properly. And with the other diversity factors that comes along with, they should be given the opportunity to do so. And so far, I mean, as the Scottish Parliament has failed to do that. So we've not yet elected a BAME, a female MP in the Scottish Parliament, which is incredibly, you know, disappointing. So even when I put the motion through in 2018 in the Scottish Labour conference, I was quite surprised that a motion like this has not come forward before. So it just goes to show that there has not been a recognition for this. And most of the time, even when I go to most political events, I look around and there's only a handful of women of diversity and women of color present in those events. So I've always felt the need to break a barrier and go forward and make sure that there's opportunities created for women like myself in the community.
Jack, I wonder if I could ask you, I mean, you've heard Dina there. I mean, it's shocking, isn't it, that Holyrood hasn't had a BAME female elected yet? It's a real failure of the system since devolution, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, we should be looking at our national parliaments and chambers and seeing them as reflective of society as a whole. And whether that be in Edinburgh, London, in your local authority, that simply is not the case. So that is certainly a road we have a long way to go down yet. But, you know, it's really interesting hearing everyone else on this. This has to be a real collective effort. There's no single answer or single solution to this. And while on the one side, it is so important that we encourage more women and more people of ethnic backgrounds to stand for parliament, it's also really important that if they are elected, we support them. You know, that doesn't end on election day. I think the turnover rate, particularly in female politicians standing down after one term, is simply something, you know, we shouldn't be proud of either. You know, on the one hand, you know, we need to do more to get women into politics, but we also need to support women that are already in politics to really fulfill their roles and not get to the stage come the next general election that they just don't want to be a part of it anymore.
Thanks, Jack. I wondered if I could turn now to another kind of theme that emerged from the Generation Next series, and that was the decisive influence, it seemed, that the 2014 Scottish independence referendum had on so many of the participants. You know, in some ways, it's an obvious observation that the referendum, which was such a huge and historic event, would politicise so many young people in Scotland. But, I mean, I personally was quite taken aback by just how important it seemed to be. And obviously, we looked in the piece at the potential implications that could have for the country's next generation of politicians, if they are indeed the children of the referendum. Caelan, you had just arrived in Scotland within a few months before the referendum, didn't you, in 2014? I wonder if you could describe the kind of effect it had on you and whether your experience is similar to others around your age group and what you think that might mean for the future of Scottish politics.
Yeah, I came at it from a really, really different angle, just because before Scotland, I spent most of my childhood in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And I moved to Scotland in the summer of 2014. I got here in July, and obviously that was the height of the referendum campaign, with the vote taking place later on in the year. And so just having been here for a couple of months, I must have been at school for a matter of weeks before the referendum took place. And it was all that was being discussed. And I think more so, or on par with, the fact that it was about independence, which is an issue that galvanizes our entire generation in one way or the other. But it was the fact that the voting age was lowered to 16 for the first time. At 14, there were people my age discussing constitutional politics. And coming from a country that does not hold elections, I had absolutely no idea what a referendum even was. And so this was a really, really eye-opening experience for me. And I assumed that every young person was clearly very politically aware. So I went out of my way to do my research, and I didn't take part in any side of the campaign. I didn't have, or think I had, much of an opinion until the day after, on the 19th. And for me, it just didn't make sense that someone would turn down, or a country could turn down, an opportunity like this, because I've always tried, my political outlook is very optimistic. And at that point, it may have even been naive to assume that it was that Scotland should have voted yes. But since then, you know, I'd kept in the loop and kept doing my research, and it didn't take me very long before I decided that I wanted to join the SNP. And for me, it's not a cultural thing. As I say, I'm not Scottish. I do class myself as a new Scot. But I don't have this kind of emotional sway that I think a lot of people do in the country. And for me, it definitely came down to facts are facts. And I think now we've gotten to the point where a majority of people, not just young people, would agree with that. And I think that's a really, really exciting thing. So I'm looking forward to the next campaign.
Max, you also mentioned it as a kind of turning point for yourself, didn't you, in terms of party politics. Would you go along with what Caelan's saying there? And what I'd put the same question to you in terms of what will it actually mean for our politics going forward? Does it mean that the Constitution is going to remain, you know, at the centre of everything until that's resolved?
Well, I hope we've not got much longer to wait until it's resolved, to be honest. And I think the election next year will be a key turning point in that. And hopefully we get a subsequent referendum, which people clearly want now. You know, just thinking back to 2014, for me, really, it's, you know, I think I discussed in my interview around how I'd been on the fringes of politics for a long time, working through activist circles and in grassroots community organising around environmental and food projects. And for me, the 2014 result was a shock, even though the polls were showing us behind all the way. Everybody I knew was a yes supporter. It was just taken for granted we would all be voting yes. And I think there was a bit of a, we'd underestimated the amount of work that it would take in order to get the result that we were looking for. So I joined the Scottish Greens the day after the referendum because it was a realization, it was a wake up call really that you can't just take for granted the result. You need to go out there and work for it. And that I really wanted to be part of that and to work for the next referendum. I think everybody involved on the yes side has been really boosted in the last few months by the polls that constantly show growing support for independence. And as a Green, it's been showing constant growing support for Green politics as well. So, the kind of questions and debates and spirit around 2014, it lives on really strongly, not just in the generation of politicians that we're seeing coming through, the generation of activists, but in what's going to come over the next year or so. But I think that's a positive thing. I don't think that's something that we need to be concerned or worried about. I think it shows the ongoing hope that we could be doing better in Scotland and that we've still got an opportunity to do better.
I mean, Jack, you'll take a different view on some of that, but I mean, it was the case that it wasn't just the yes side where the referendum became a kind of pivotal moment, was it? I mean, you were heavily involved in the local Better Together campaign in Orkney while you're just at school, isn't that right?
Yeah, that is right. I held a campaign coordinating role for the No side in Orkney, which would go on to be Scotland's highest No vote. But I think there was, you know, across both sides, there was a real understanding that this moment was really seismic. Here we were presented with what kind of future we wanted. And, you know, come general elections, yeah, very important topics are debated, but sometimes you're often looking very in the short term, whereas the referendum in 2014, here we were debating what kind of future we wanted. So, and as Caelan highlighted, being the first time that 16 and 17-year-olds could vote, this was a real motivator. And kind of looking back, I think the quality of debate in 2014 was actually quite high. Yes, of course, very heated at times. But, you know, when you look at how contemporary debate in politics since then has really been lowered, you know, particularly from 2016 onwards. So, you know, I think people were probably infused by the quality of debate as well as other factors such as lowering the voting age and being presented with this you know, really seismic moment that you could get involved with.
And Braden, I mean, would you disagree with what you've heard there? I mean, would you fear that one of the consequences is going to be that you know, the polarisation of politics that really kind of reached a new level around the time of the referendum is just going to be here to stay?
I think it's for me, and I know a lot of other people, you know, some people say, you know, it was this great civic joyous event, but for a lot of people it was really divisive, really quite nasty, you know, and people lost friends, families, got into arguments, people fell out with one another. And I think the idea that we end up, you know, going back to that place that we were again is, you know, the last thing people want to do just now. And I think, you know, people, quite obviously, some people got really involved and motivated because of the referendum on both sides. And my personal view is it's quite a shame that this continues to be the dominant topic of conversation when, you know, I think everyone got into politics to improve things. Looking at schools and hospitals, I would like the same passion that was put in for that referendum to be put into other areas, you know, making sure young people get jobs. How can we improve the attainment gap at school? So I think it is a missed opportunity if we continue going, you know, and we've had two constitutional referendums in a short period of time. And I think referendums are, by their very nature, divisive. People are forced, you know, what are complex, nuanced arguments are forced into two camps on a ballot box. And I think it is a shame that so many people were divided that way and fell out over that. And I think we should really focus on trying to find common ground in these areas rather than go back over the arguments that we've already had.
I would just add into that as well. I think there's probably something that's established itself within British politics at the moment where the big questions that we face as a country somehow have to be decided in very simple yes and no, leave and remain in terms, and, you know, rip up the constitutional framework to try and find solutions. But actually, that's going to create a lot more problems in the process. We've seen that with Brexit. You know, that's fractioned into a million problems for the country. So, you know, I think we should try in this next decade, try and get into territory where we approach some of these big questions, but more constructively. So how could we fix the things and the structures that we currently have to work and deliver for people rather than to divide and disillude?
And Caelan, you had some thoughts on that you wanted to come in on?
Yeah, I just wanted to add and say, you know, I do agree that it is an upsetting thing that politics can be divisive, but I think it's really important to note that for some, our reason for being involved in politics is our lived experience, and it's not just a matter of opinion. When we came to the EU referendum in 2016, for me and for so many other EU immigrants across the UK, this result has the potential, we still don't know what that's going to look like, but has the potential to tear our families apart. I'm lucky enough that I'm a British citizen, but my mum isn't. So does this mean in 6 months' time, if she isn't granted leave to remain, that we won't be able to live in the same country anymore? When it comes to independence, I think that, as Jack had mentioned, and, you know, tearing up the constitution and that kind of language can make it seem a very negative thing, but the British constitution clearly isn't working. It isn't working for the children that are going to have to go without food over these Christmas holidays. It isn't working for BAME people. It isn't working for women. And there's just so many things that I think need to be taken into account, as much as it is upsetting to fall out with family and friends over a matter of opinion. But for some people, it isn't just that. It's so much more. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
And I just wondered if I could take in Dina on the same issue in terms of 2014, because you'd been in Aberdeen for a few years by that point. Is that correct? Well, I mean, what did you make of it all?
So I think I spoke about this with you, Callum, the last time we spoke. So I refrained from voting in that election because I had just been in Scotland for 4 years at that point in time. I thought I didn't know much, even though I knew the facts and stuff that I researched online. I did not have enough time and experience speaking to the people and understanding what the common notion was. So I refrained from voting in that election. However, doing a lot of campaigns and door-to-door canvassing, I've learned a lot about this issue. And the fact that young people was very idealistic when they wanted to vote in that election, particularly to leave, because their main concerns were education, healthcare, social services. But then when the debates were going on, and even up to date, it's very clear that all these debates are very clouded with a bit nationalism and patriotic rhetoric, where there is not much figures and facts that are in place. Most young people say that it's like another Brexit. There is no plan. There is no plan if there is going to be a border between England or Scotland. There is no plan if Scotland will get to keep the sterling pound. There is no plan if Scotland can enter the EU. This is just another uncertainty that's been created, just like Brexit. So this is a common notion that, you know, by just speaking to people that I'm hearing. I am all about creating symbiotic and beneficial relationships. And I'm also about, if there's a toxic relationship, leaving that as well. But in order to do anything, I think there needs to be better planning, and people need to be given real information and real facts. I also think, in my opinion, that if the SNP government focuses on all the devolved matters that the Scottish Parliament has the power to create laws and legislation for, just the same way that they are focusing on an independence referendum, I think Scotland would be very prosperous than we are right now.
Okay, we're seeing that this is still a hot topic. I mean, Mags, you want to come back on on what Dino's saying there?
I just wanted to challenge the notion that's come across from a few people that we're not able to do anything at the moment because we're too busy debating the constitution. I appreciate if you just watch First Minister's Question Time, it might come across like that. But as somebody who works in Holyrood, I mean, the amount of work that we're doing at the moment is huge. And we are, as Greens, we're very much about maximising the powers that we have right now in order to demonstrate to people what we can do, both as a devolved government, but also what we can do in independent Scotland as well. So, you know, over the last few years, we've been working incredibly hard in the Scottish Parliament to deliver, you know, free bus travel for under 19s, which is out to consultation just now. You know, Greens have delivered fair funding for councils in the annual budgets. Just this summer, Ross Greer managed to overturn the hugely unfair decisions around exams and got students right across Scotland their fair exam grades as set by their teachers restored. So I think it's a very lazy argument that some have sometimes that we're not able to do anything because we're too busy tied up with the independence question. Actually, we can achieve a lot and we need to be working hard to achieve that, but also we can achieve so much more under independence as well.
I just kind of turning slightly away from that issue. Otherwise, we'll be here all day. Just as a kind of final thought, I wonder, obviously, we've discussed here the impact of the referendum on people who are at school and university at the kind of 2014 period. Just thinking of what we're going through at the moment, the pandemic, and obviously schools and universities hugely affected. And just wondering if anyone has any thoughts on what kind of impact that's likely to have on perhaps the generation that follows yourselves. Is there going to be, Scottish politics dominated by the children of the pandemic one day, and what might their kind of outlook have been affected by what's going on at the moment, do you think?
Yeah, I think the pandemic is obviously akin to what the 2014 referendum would be, you know, a generation defining moment. And I think, you know, it will definitely have long-lasting implications, not necessarily just on people's political views or how they see the world, you know, on their economic futures, on their ability to start a career, build a family, buy a house. You know, this will have huge repercussions. And my hope is, as we come to the pandemic, is we really build that sense of community. You know, we on this panel, we all have differing political views, but I think we all have that sense of, you know, we want to care for one another. If people are ill, we want to look after people. And I hope that after the pandemic, you know, politics and the next generation come with less of a sort of a divisive view and more on, you know, building common ground, you know, looking over the areas we disagree on and looking to areas we do agree on would be my hope. And I certainly hope that's the way we go.
Dina, your PhD is actually in public health. I mean, what do you think the long-term implications from what we're going through just now might be?
I think there are negatives and positives as for any issue that we might encounter. I think one of the negative aspects is the fact that younger generation who are just graduating, their prospects of finding a job is quite low. Especially in places like Aberdeen, which has been affected, by so many different issues, starting off with the oil downturn and now the pandemic as well. So, I mean, that, I think the younger generation, they're not getting a fair chance at life starting from there. And then again, when you look at the school leavers, I mean, the recent SQA issue as well. So even that is an implication for them. You know, most in my constituency, a lot of parents have gotten in touch with me because most students hadn't, their conditional offer has been rejected by universities. Now, even that issue is going to implicate their entire life going forward. As for positive aspects, I think sense of community and appreciation for key workers, professions, and including, you know, healthcare, you know, including journalism as well. So these are kind of professions where, you know, possibly two generations ago, maybe, you know, school leavers were not thinking about possibly doing degrees in these areas. They were looking at doing degrees in probably investment banking, finance, business, and areas like that. So I'm really interested to see of next year and the year after what kind of degrees that students will be applying for, and to see that as well. And I think we've understood to appreciate, you know, family and staying together as well. As younger people, and finding creative ways in order to keep in contact with people. Creativity, I think, has been high level at this current period of time. Resilience as well. So there's a lot of lessons learned from here. And I think the next generation would be more resilient. That's what I believe.
Jack, do you think there'll be positives to come out of all the difficulties we're going through just now?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's we set our sights on making sure that we maximize our recovery in opportunity. So there's no question, you know, even before the pandemic, young people were getting a pretty rough deal. You know, half as likely to get on the nation's housing ladder, career prospects. And young people have faced a very challenging time in recent months, whether it's been in school or university, or in employment as well. So the pandemic, it's, you know, it's laid societal injustices and inequalities bare. So what we've got to do now, and what I've heard from everyone else, you know, sounds really promising, is that, you know, we can take a collective approach to this. And, you know, now that everything's been laid bare, we can, you know, try and have recovery, as I said, that's going to be grounded in opportunity. And I think the really important focus we should try and have is to make sure it's a green recovery. So how can we get, you know, better paying, greener jobs for the future, a more sustainable economy? You know, I know back home in Orkney, many industries are becoming more sustainable for the future. So that's, I think there's a lot to learn from that as we look to the years ahead.
Mags, I presume you would go along with what Jack's saying there and be hoping for a green recovery to take centre stage.
Absolutely, I would, but it needs to be a proper, well planned, well funded recovery. Unfortunately, what we're finding, you know, there was particularly earlier on in the year, there was a lot of good talk from government about a green and fair recovery, but actually there's very little action on delivering that. There's very little commitment, and there's very little support. So, I mean, what this generation, I honestly, I'm worried. I'm really worried for people leaving school and leaving university over the next few years. I left university in the middle of the last recession, and I found that difficult. And what we're facing at the moment just now is not just recovery from a global pandemic and the economic implications, but also the future impending climate change crisis as well. So we have to get serious about what we're looking for here. We need to see huge restructuring of our economy. And using the investment that we know we need to make through climate change to support us to build back better and to support young people and to create these jobs. So we're talking a mass retrofitting program for homes, scrapping gas boilers and switching towards zero carbon heating. No, we're talking about retrofitting building our island ferries so that we can have carbon neutral ferries. You know, we're talking about a proper investment in the renewable supply chain so that we can bring jobs to places like Byfab and Fife. You know, we know what needs to be done, but it requires commitment. And I'm concerned that the governments at all levels in Scotland and the UK at the moment don't really understand the scale that's needed.
And finally, Caelan, I mean, what would be your thoughts on that? Are you positive? You're obviously, you're at university just now, and you're facing some of these issues that Mags touched on. I mean, what's your kind of outlook on it all?
Yeah, I think just building on what Mags was saying, I think something else on that is that we've been shown that every decision that is taken by both respective governments in Scotland and the UK that everything is a political choice. What money is put into is a political choice. You know, there was money for the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. But as I mentioned earlier, there's no money for free school meals. So it really has shown our generation yet again that if you have to be political and you have to be engaged. And I think just as before the pandemic, we were seeing weekly, monthly climate strikes from young people. And I think before this point, but even more so now, that young people are not willing to sit by and have their futures dictated to them. And I think this is going to be a generation that are very politicized and very ready to stand up for what they believe in.
That's a really interesting point to end on. And, you know, perhaps some or all of you five might be the ones making those political choices one day. It'll certainly be fascinating to watch your careers develop over the coming years. My thanks again go to Kaylin, Braden, Dina, Jack and Mags for taking part in this series and for sharing their insights with us today. If you haven't already, please go and read more about them and what they had to say to us in their Generation Next interviews on the P&J and Courier websites, not to mention those of the other 30 participants as well. I've been Callum Ross and this has been The Stooshy.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.